Hello. Welcome to recording number 11 of Gary Gygax's Saga of Old City. We begin with Chapter 8, page 76, paragraph 1. "A dragon," exclaimed Lord Dolph. "You must now beat three towers, your reverence." Patricians' Club, a luxurious gaming house in Greyhawk's High Quarter, had many tables, each offering a different amusement for those rich and noble gamers who saw excitement and the thrill of wagering fortunes upon chance. Little skill was required. Most of what transpired depended upon the spin of a wheel, the sum of oddly shaped dice, and similar devices where random patterns allowed long odds and dumb luck to reign supreme. At an ornately carved table in a special corner, however, a game that pitted players directly against each other was taking place. Right. Well, I mean, we have the introduction of at least one character here, Lord Dolph, the mention of the Patricians Club and the High Quarter, and this is the first actually building described in the High Quarter. A luxurious gaming house. We have the amusing, a little description there of what is going on, and that the various games of chance are very much of chance with dumb luck rather than skill, except for the last one mentioned. And in a little aside to D&D, we have the sum of oddly shaped dice, which early on was always one of the hallmarks of Dungeons & Dragons, that it used what to normal people who were used to a D6, or at most a D10, thought of the various polyhedron dice as oddly shaped. I'm going to restart right here. It is page 76, paragraph 3. "Five wealthy participants were involved. They had contested for several hours now, fortune smiling first upon one, then another, so that not a single player had yet been forced to quit the table for lack of funds. Most notorious of the five was Arentall, the Grand Guildmaster of Thieves, a tall, thin fellow of saturnine nature and somber dress. He always watched the eyes of his opponents with an unblinking gaze. Next to Arentall was Sir Margus, a very young, effete-looking villainese. His age, combined with his title, indicated that he was undoubtedly the son of a great noble, and thus had gained his knighthood through means other than bold deeds. Adjacent to the villainese knight was Madame Beldre. The widow of Deagol Beldre was certainly one of the richest commoners in the city, so wealthy that she could move in noble circles without question. She was plump and soft and covered with jewels. In a pudgy, middle-aged way, Madame Beldre was attractive, so she was much sought after by men whose fortunes were in flux, so to speak. This night she was clad in brocaded silk of ivory and golden hues that nearly matched the colors of her fading blonde tresses. Just after Lord Dolph, the Baron of Carnway, spoke triumphantly regarding his newly displayed tableau, Madame Beldre smiled vacuously at the man to her left, Bronstein, a high priest of Zilchus, and said, 'Oh my goodness, can you imagine such luck? Do you suppose you can beat Lord Dolph's three towers? What will you do?' Without comment, the richly dressed priest seated between the lady and Lord Dolph turned over the ivory plaque before him, his long, pale fingers seeming to move contemptuously. He smiled as a green horse head was revealed on the reverse side. 'That makes a host of four, I believe, Lord Baron.' The sour expression that came over Lord Dolph's face as he viewed the emerald depictions of bow, sword, and spear, capped by the horse, showed that it was indeed a host, a powerful tableau. All of the men now turned to watch as Madame Beldray took her turn. "That's no good at all," the plump dowager said in a tone of disappointment, as her bejeweled hand exposed a plaque with the green magic sigil on it. Now His Reverence, the High Priest Vronstein, would gain no all-conquering host, at least, but the madam still had but a pair of coffers to show. She turned over two more of the ivory tiles, revealing the dwarf and a crown. The crown could build to a winning hand, but only if her two remaining plaques were likewise coffers, and those were long odds. With only two players remaining for her, Madame Belfry must either, with only two plays remaining for her, Madame Beldray must either wager or yield. "I feel dreadfully lucky this evening," she stated enthusiastically, "so I shall increase the stake by another orb. No, by another plate." She pushed a platinum lozenge into the pile of coins in the center of the table. Break. Well, we have the introduction of several characters here. Vronstein, the High Priest of Zilchus, is introduced, which is humorous as Zilchus, is the patron deity of luck. Here we have example of how his high priest within the city. We have mentioned here that Arentol is not just the guildmaster of thieves, but at this point, which is several years after the Beggar Thief War, is being called the Grand Guildmaster of Thieves. A little bit of his physical description: as a tall, thin fellow of saturnine nature and somber dress. Now, also that seems a very steady individual, watching his opponent with unblinking eyes. We have Lord Dolph, who is the Baron of Carnway. So with the introduction of this barony, not really connected with any particularly locale. Is it a barony in the area of Greyhawk? Now, we have Sir Margus, who is a young effete Valonese, and he is thought to be a Valonese knight. So he is, he has been defined as where his locale is. And Lord Dolph is the Baron of Carnway. There's no context given of at this point of where Carnway might actually be. And then we have Madame Beldray, mention of her deceased husband, Deagle Beldray, as wealthy commoners. So we have some description here of how the city is set up, with the nobility and aristocracy, and also wealth that can bring even a commoner into that kind of society. Now, we haven't had the High Quarter mentioned before, but in the city of Greyhawk, the High Quarter is the home of the most the estates of the elite. So it is the most respected area within the city, with the nearby Garden Quarter, the Citadel being very nearby, which is the castle and the home of the Lord Mayor. All right. We have some beginnings of descriptions of this, almost a card game that they're playing. But obviously they're not using paper cards, they're using these ivory plaques. So it seems like it's some form of primitive poker, but at the same time it is played with plaques rather than cards. All right. Now, it also goes to show, besides some detail on what the card games, what this card game or the plaque game here has as far as, what hand is beating what other hand, what it also has is that that Madame Beldray, who raises the stakes, she's raising it by a platinum plate, which is equivalent to 1,100 bronzes. And if we think back to the previous chapter, Prosper, the tutor, he is only getting between San and Gord 2 bronzes a day, teaching 6 days a week. And this one plaque, this one platinum plate is worth 1,100 of those bronzes. So in this casual game, high stakes, but game among the wealthy, they're betting so that even a sage is that value, you know, is over a year. Just the one coin she's raising the stakes in is over a year of what Prosper the sage could make teaching 2 students. So the difference, but disparity here between the wealthy and even the respected academics is vast, and it is deeply different between the commoner, the menial laborer, and even the craftsman is not going to make anything like these wealthy people possess. All right, I am going to restart right here. It is page 77, the last paragraph. There was some surprise among the players when Sir Margus not only met the stake, but increased it by an orb. He had lost rather heavily this night, and now seemed bent on bankrupting himself by attempting to recoup it all in one losing hand. He showed 3 tiles up, red sigil and 2 gates. Tarantal likewise had 3 up and 4 plaques down, with 3 spears showing. It seems that playing with a blessed cleric is unwise, said the guildmaster. He too had lost considerable sums. I'm caught between towers. His reverence, a lady who feels relish as, smiles upon her, and a risk-taker extraordinaire, he observed. And worse, I think I can garner no 5th spear, even should the 4th be here, he added as he tapped his tiles. So I must yield. He quietly turned over his exposed plaques and sat back. Lord Dolph placed his platinum and gold coins into the pot. Then his reverence, Vronstein, increased the wager by yet another plate. Reluctantly, Madame Beldray met it. Sir Margus did likewise, only after going to his purse. And then Lord Dolph also saw the bet. The action passed to the young knight. Let us see with whom fortune actually plays, Sir Margus said as he casually flipped the next flat ivory rectangle so as to show its face. Black sigil. Cities and magic don't mix, sir, urged Lord Dolph. Let's get on with it. Without any indication that he took offense at the mustachioed baron's rudeness, the young man lazily reached for his next plaque and tipped it. He ruminated, eyes now fixed upon the baron. The bet was again demanded by the rules of the game, for Sir Margus had but 2 tiles remaining face down. It was evident from the facial expressions of the other players they did not envy him his position. Already in deep, he had but little chance to defeat the cleric's host, while the Baron Dolph had some considerable opportunity. Let us be restrained, a lucky, offered the young knight. As the electrum disc went into the center of the table, Lord Dolph was already shoving 2 coins in, and an orb, he said with menacing flatness in his voice. Margus had but a few pieces of currency before him on the table, and the baron thought it time to force the upstart youngster out of the play. Each of the others at the table saw the wager. Sir Margus stared at the glitter of gold, silver, platinum, and electrum in the pot, shook his head, and stared at the baron. As Dolph smiled condescendingly at him, a gold coin appeared in the young man's hand, and he said, I'll see the wager also. Now everyone at the table was watching with enhanced interest. This hand was becoming a personal matter of pride between two noblemen, and by this time the game had attracted the attention of a small crowd of onlookers. They kept a respectful distance, and after each play the ones in the front ranks would turn and whisper the latest happenings to those behind them. Sir Margus glanced toward the spectators and smiled faintly, as if amused by a secret joke. Then he revealed his sixth plaque. Madame Beldray gasped and clutched at the golden brocade of her gown with a plump hand when she saw a white sigil. Sir Margus fixed Lord Dolph with a piercing gaze, holding the Baron's eyes as the young Valonese knight slowly displayed his next plaque. Several of the onlookers voiced subdued cheers when the second dragon in the stack appeared. That could stand for the green sigil exposed in Madame Beldray's tableau. Now the young nobleman had completed the mage, a nearly unbeatable display. "I believe it is your play, Baron," said Sir Margus said laconically and without looking down. Livid, Lord Dolph reached for his next tile. It was the elf. No help. Hurriedly he turned the next, another tower, and it was time to consider the stakes. "Plate, I say, and be damned." His hand shook as the paunchy Baron put the coin into the pot with an angry toss. Madame Beldray yielded her tableau. She could no longer hope luck would save her. The cleric and the Valonese knight put platinum lozenges into the pot without ado. Guildmaster Arenthal observed the whole affair with fascination. "Istus, that's five towers you now face," roared the Baron, as his sixth plaque turned out to be another of the castle symbols. Lord Dolph's tableau was now supreme on the board. His florid countenance was wreathed in smugness as he looked from High Priest Vronstein to Sir Margus, his pale eyes red-rimmed but gloating. Break. All right, well, this has a little description of some of the various characters. We hear that Lord Dolph is florid, that he is paunchy. But mostly this just is about the gameplay that is going on in this game of plaques. It's not there's no real rules explanation. If the game is actually something real and not just terms that are made up for this gameplay that we're being shown right here, then we are given certain definitions and certain ranks of, you know, of the order of the of what is going on in the game. Lord the Baron's, Lord Dolph, his sixth, his five towers are now the supreme hand on the table. I like his exclamation. We have the mention of Ralishaz, who's lucky, the deity of luck, and we have the mention here of Istus, who by the Baron, who is a Baclunish deity, but is the deity of fate. This goes more toward give the idea of, although we aren't explained that context here, it goes more, if you're familiar with the Greyhawk setting, about the cosmopolitan nature of the city of Greyhawk. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 79, and it is the final paragraph. "Calmly, dear Baron, calmly," admonished the haughty-faced cleric as he carefully exposed his fifth tile. "Blue horse's head was some help, but not much, especially in the face of five towers. I must trust in the divine direction I now require, he stated. Flipped an orb into the air and let it fall on the table before him. It showed a throne. Pops, so I am to go on. Consider the gold piece my fresh wager, he said. Neither of the other players increased this sum, so the cleric continued his play. The sixth tile was yet another war piece, a black sword. After a moment of hesitation, perhaps for a silent prayer, Bronstein revealed his seventh and last plaque. It was, incredibly, a red horse head, Calvary. I offer you the allied host, the cleric said, with a casual gesture toward the green infantry pieces and trio of horses. Is it not the superior of five towers? Now it was High Priest Vronstein's turn to sit back and watch, for this seemed the end of all hopes for his opponents. Before Sir Margus could play, Lord Dolph exclaimed, "We're men here, I believe. It seems time that we showed what we are made of. I say we make an additional wager on who shall have the winning tableau when all plaques are exposed. What say you, Vronstein?" And pointedly ignoring the young knight, Lord Dolph was indicating that he thought Sir Margus would not have sufficient funds, or perhaps the fortitude to continue. With his allied host before him, the cleric acquiesced with a smile. The baron then placed six orbs into the pot. Even the priest was startled at that. He reached into a sash and withdrew a like amount, still smiling, but now shaking his head as if saddened by the gambling lust of the others at the table. Now it was up to Sir Margus. If he met the added stake, took out a flat purse and upended it before him. Out dropped five coins, four orbs and a plate. He added these to a stack of five luckies on the table, but he was still short of the wager. Desperately, the young man dug into his tunic breast pocket, there finding three more electrum coins. He sat back with dejection on his face. "Well, sir, now, sir," crowed the baron, who seemed to be a single lucky short of making the six orbs additional wager. "By the rules of play, you now stand forfeit." In desperation, the Velenese knight looked around the table at the others. "Will one of you kind folk, nobles all, not lend me a single lucky so that I may continue the test?" he asked in a friendly tone. Stony eyes and hard faces were the only reply to this. Then, just as Lord Dolph was about to demand once again that he yield his tiles, the knight held up his hand and snapped his fingers. "Why, how foolish of me," exclaimed. "In the heat of the play, I seem to have forgotten all about my joss piece." With that, he shoved his chair back, tugged off the tooled leather boot from his left foot, and tipped the thing upside down over his hand. He placed a worn electrum coin on top of the others, pushed the stack into the pot, and said offhandedly, "My play, I suppose." The knight's seventh tile was black, and the last of the sigils in the stack. A great coup indeed. "My tableau now displays the Archmage, bettering his reverence Vronstein's allied host," announced Sir Margus. "And your five towers as well, Baron, unless you can best it with that single plaque you have yet undisclosed." The face of Lord Dolph turned nearly purple, and he sputtered as he reached for the tile. "Now you, Sir, hold, sir, I say," the Velenese knight commanded. "You have belittled me without stint since the game began. You have tested my temper, my purse, and my spirit. Now let us test yours. I have no coin left, but here upon my finger is a ring of bright gold with the fair green of a cat's-eye chrysoberyl peering forth, a family treasure of value both sentimental and otherwise. Though it is worth far more, let it have the value of a mere 3 orbs. If you have metal, sir, you will accept this additional stake ere you turn your final tile. No noble could turn from such a challenge, though Lord Dolph would doubtless never forgive the challenger. He glared with open hatred at the young Valonese. You say it is greater value, so be it. I wager 3 plates, not 3 orbs, against it. Turn your tile then, Baron, and may the better man win. The plaque bore the grinning face of the thief. Baron Dolph had lost. All right, break. Most of this just goes toward setting up what could be, a scenario or a background information for a high-class gambling house within the high quarter city of Greyhawk. We're given more information about the game, how it's run with the tiles being turned, and rules about having to raise the wager if you're turning, an extra tile. But we're really mostly given just this atmosphere of how the gambling house and the immense amount of coin that is being tossed into this pot. When they're talking about three plates and orbs, we are also given a little information that the Electrum Lucky certainly has a good fractional value of a gold piece. So, you know, we look at a gold piece and it is 1,000 bronzes, and that a platinum plate is 1,100 bronzes, and I believe the Electrum is a fifth or a sixth of a gold coin. And if that is the case, then we're looking at it being worth, over 100 bronzes. So right here, we have what would be to even like the Sage Prosper. We have in one pot, several years worth of income just in this one pot, with all the gold coins and all the platinum coins that are being tossed about. This is a vast amount of money in the city of Greyhawk for the commoner, for the academic. But in even among the wealthy, we see that it is not unexpected that this foreign Valonese knight, who appears to be very wealthy, he cannot match the coin being put on this table at this point. And he has to, at the very end, draw off a ring and add that to the pot to increase the stakes.
He uses a term, joss piece. I'm not sure, is that a term for the lucky, or?
No, I would assume it is the Electrum Lucky, but joss is a Asian term referring to the joss sticks, and it is a term that I believe covers things like luck and divination and magic in what would be an Asian setting. Now, the campaign that Gygax is describing eventually does make reference to pseudo-Asian countries. It is kind of strange that the Valonese knight has a joss piece. But again, that does fit. It is an Electrum Lucky. It's kept in a shoe. It could be a Greyhawk or a Valonese custom, a bit of superstition to take a lucky for luck and put it in the shoe. And I would assume that the joss piece means the lucky piece. Okay. I had seen that too. It almost slipped my mind there. There's actually this, this covers quite a bit of chapter 8, and chapter 8 is in the way that they have combat action, this is the gambling house action. And there isn't really, other than the description of the game that is being played, but not the real rules, but just, you know, if you didn't know poker and you were being told about the hands without context, you couldn't really come up with the rules for poker the way that they're just by a few commentary. But it also gives a little bit of information about how the nobility who would be in this gambling house would react, and a little background if you wanted to do a scenario for the game in there. This could provide you with background to read to your players about what was going on or directly involved, about how they might be one of the witnesses to the game. So there's a little bit of background here, but not a lot of campaign detail.
I didn't remember this game at first. I still don't really remember it. And I've read the books maybe twice before. One time very well, and the other, I guess, not so well. But I do remember that ring.
Yes. The ring, I believe, you know, looking a little ahead, that it has some other meaning with it. And the game itself, what I didn't remember at first is, from the description, I'd first assumed it was a card game. But instead, it is played with ivory plaques.
Yeah, it seems like Stratego or something.
Well, I think it might be closer to, there is a gambling game among the wealthy, Baccarat.
Oh, yeah.
That sure. I believe is played with plaques rather than with cards. And I've never played it myself. I've only seen it like in James Bond pictures.
Yeah, the people behind are cordoned off, and they play behind, you know, an area where the common people can't get near them.
Yes, and even the lesser wealthy can't get near them. The other thing, I mean, we do hear a little about how it goes. It seems like you're given 7 face-down plaques that you turn over as the it goes, and as you're passed on, you can maybe turn over 2 and then raise, and then it's passed to the next player who has to meet it or raise. And it does seem that there's also that you don't have to turn over the plaques at the same rate as somebody else. You know, that it seems to pass around to the person raising the stake, then gets to add a show a plaque. But if you just meet the wager, it doesn't seem like you have to. I'm not familiar with a game system quite like that. This may actually be very much like Baccarat, but I'm completely unfamiliar with the rules.
Okay.
All right. Now I'm going to restart. It is page 82. And it is the first paragraph. Later, in a lavish suite at the Villa Noblesse, 3 young people were laughing and drinking, toasting the occasion with heady, sparkling violet wine from Ulrich's southern region. A pile of gold discs, platinum rectangles, and electrum coins were arrayed as the centerpiece. "You're absolutely crazy, Gord," said the curvaceous Tilline. "I thought I'd faint when you couldn't meet the Baron's extra stakes. And then the ring, marvelous." "Marvelous, perhaps," interjected the tall blonde youth called Sunray. "Yet I must know how you thought you'd turn that sigil." "I cheated," Gord said without inflection. "What?" cried Tilline, laughing and reaching over to hug him. "How could you have cheated? Silly Madame Beldray dealt the plaques." "I'm good. No one saw me, but I changed the last plaque dealt to me for one I chose, the black sigil." "The guildmaster at the table." "Oh, so what, Tilline?" Sunray chimed in. "Big deal. Everyone was watching the coins tossed into the pot." It was obvious that Sunray was trying to steal the limelight from Gord Margus. jealous of his success and the attention it gained from their female companion. Even so, how did he know that Lord Dolph didn't have the fifth tower? Elaine demanded, addressing Sunray and then looking to Gord. Gord smiled his most boyish grin at her and simply said, "I didn't." Break. We have the introduction of two new characters right here, kind of out of the blue, because we now have Talene and Sunray. We also, since Gord is able to pass as a young knight, there have been a number of years that have occurred in mention since the end of the Beggar Thief War, and I would put Gord's age at 18 or older. Definitely with the time that has passed. Now, it had been mentioned that he was going, leaving his education after 2 years at Grey College, a year with Prosper, that he was going to go and see what he could do for himself up in the High Quarter. So here he is in the High Quarter, and I suspect that he is now 18, 19, or even older, and able to pass as a young noble. Again, one of the themes is this business of disguise, obviously the Lord Dolph does not have that ability to discern that Gord is playing a role and in disguise, but he has backed himself up with quite a bit of education, so that Gord isn't very far along from anybody in the slum or thieves' quarter. Now, we have mention of the Villa Noblesse, which is some kind of hotel or inn, at least some kind of staying place up in the High Quarter, I would assume. We have mention of the sparkling violet wine from Ulloch's southern region. So, I mean, that gives us a little game material there that we can think then that... there was mention of a Selene wine from Selene, and now we have mention of a wine from Ulloch, so that perhaps the southern region of Ulloch has vineyards. It's obviously something that is an expensive wine, as they have moved up into the High Quarter. We have a little bit of physical description of Sunray, tall blonde youth, and it's hard to tell whether he is older or younger or the same age as Gord from this right here. And again, we have that Gord is, a risk taker, because at the very end, not only did he take the risk of cheating in front of all the others and Arentol, but also that he took the risk of not really knowing whether he could win or lose, even with the cheating. So there's a little description here of little campaign info and a little description of more of Gord and what kind of personality he's developed into, and the introduction of several characters within this chapter. All right, I'm going to restart. This is chapter 9, page 83, paragraph 1. It had been more than 2 years now since Gord had left the university and come to the northern portion of Greyhawk, moving back and forth from High to Garden Quarter as his whim or opportunity dictated. In one guise or another, Gord had plied his profession as thief among the most wealthy and powerful citizens of the city without a qualm. Never once had he been detected, although suspicion occasionally had forced him to retire one persona and assume a new one. By choosing carefully and striking infrequently, he had kept the officials of the city guessing as to what was going on. A great many of his operations had been so well conceived and well executed that the victims were left unaware that they had been swindled, cheated, or robbed. A game earlier this week, for instance, 3 orbs could support a man modestly for a year, and Gord had virtually stolen more than 10 times that much from the other players. Break. we have more time passing. So we have the 1 year with Prosper, 2 years with Gray College, perhaps 3 years before that since the end of the Beggar War, and now two more years with Gord in the High and Garden Quarters. So we have Gord probably now in his early 20s. And obviously, not only have his skills improved as he's done these amazing swindles and robberies without detection, but we also see that he has, he has the intelligence to work out, when he needs to stop being one person, become another person, and more of this business of Gord learning to disguise himself. That is always an underlying theme so far in Saga of the Old City, is that there is quite a number of situations where Gord or even someone, some other person, disguises themselves. And the other hand is that people of experience and knowledge seem to be able to see beneath that disguise. Now, finally, we have that the High and Garden Quarters seem to be equally the wealthiest areas of the city. And Gord had, back at the beginning, gone with Violet into the Garden Quarter. And now we see with him staying in the High Quarter and doing his con in the High Quarter among the wealthiest and most powerful, like Arentol, the Grand Guildmaster of Thieves. He's able now to step in among the highest class of the people of the city of Greyhawk. Now, finally, we are seeing again at the value. One of the things that has changed, of course, with Gord, too, is that he and San had felt themselves very wealthy if they had maintained a simple life in the craftsman's quarter or even among the academics in the Clerkburg or the university area. And now, here he earns 30 golden orbs. And 3 golden orbs are supposed to let support a man modestly for a year. Well, 3 golden orbs, that would keep Prosper going for 10 years, perhaps. And, because it's equal, 3 golden orbs is 3,000 bronzes. And so Gord appears to have moved up in his society so much that he thinks that that much coin is only modestly for a year. And of course, in this one score, Gord has taken in 30 gold pieces. And it shows 30 gold is, even for the wealthy, that is a large amount of coin. And it really it sets to shame the economy that is shown in the D&D books, where you're paying so many coin and that players are starting out with all this gold coins, and here it is a veritable fortune to have 30 gold coins.
Yeah, you could support yourself modestly for a decade.
Yes, and that is one game of this game that they're playing. And in that 10 years of high living, it's 30 golden coins. So you can see where if you go and low-level, adventuring, that you're going to be getting rewards in the brass bits and the bronzes and the copper commons. And there really seems to be a very big raise between the value of those kind of coins to, say, like the Electrum Lucky. So you really, and these coins have, among commoners, a big value. Like I said, Prosper is only earning about, well, between Gord and Sand, he's only earning
6 a week, right? 60s a week?
Yes, he's earning Well, he's earning 12.
Okay.
Because he's getting a bronzy from each of them, as well as the meal. But even at that, you're only looking at, like, say, 600 or so, because he's only doing 6 days a week. So you're only looking at about 600 or so bronzies a year for Prosper. And, you know, 1,000 is, so basically every gold orb is a little less than 2 years' worth of income for an academic. Maybe not the most wealthy academic, but still, a minor academic is going to, 2 gold coins, it's going to be, you know, practically 2 years' worth of wages. And that just tells you my, you know, the difference that Gord has, that there are the real rich, and then there are the, you know, the, maybe the people who are better off than others. But it also states something that when you can have a commoner, like Madame Beldre, who is now so wealthy as a commoner, doesn't say why she's wealthy, but she is so wealthy that she can throw around this kind of money. So it does talk about that the aristocracy in the city certainly does not have a complete control over, you know, where the money is coming in, if she can be a commoner being that rich. And also that wealth will open up doors, even among the nobility in the city. All right. I'm going to restart. It is page 83, paragraph 3. Lean, Sunray, and Gord were part of an active, loosely associated group who plied the arts and crafts of thievery without license from the guild or acknowledgement of the guild's authority. It should go without saying that no portion of their illicit gains crossed the palms of the guild leaders, and thus no funds from these operations came into the coffers of the city and its officials. Thievery was at best a dangerous profession. For despite the influence of the guild and the implicit sanction of its actions by the officials of Greyhawk, the laws were still the laws. A thief caught in the act was subject to a range of punishment, going from bondage all the way to execution in various horrible ways. However, members of the guild were safe from prosecution, so long as they avoided discovery on the job, and reported their activities afterwards and paid their tithe. Disgruntled citizens seeking retribution had little recourse against the guild, save personal challenge or the hiring of an assassin. Vendettas involving the Thieves Guild were not healthy pursuits. Break. All right, well, you know, earlier on, you know, I talked about, and I think we'd wondered about, how the Thieves Guild fitted their activities within the city. And here we see that it is a very Darwinistic way, that even though once they were successful, not caught in the act of thievery, that they simply had to pay the money to the officials, and that was that. And the private citizen then had to take it up as a personal, you know, a challenge by or the individual or hire an assassin. But again, that it seems like any such person may not be long for this world, that the Thieves Guild would not only protect their thieves from successful thefts and swindles, but also they would protect them from later retribution from whoever was stolen from. Now, it seems more like and likely that it would be rich aristocrats or merchants who would be robbed, and the people of power in themselves, like clerics and mages, experienced warriors and other thieves, that they would not be likely to be the ones who were pursued by these operations by the Thieves Guild. So we have, again, that this is a very, the city of Greyhawk is not, it seems to have a great deal of order, and it's even got its own order and method toward the Thieves Guild. And it just is the cost of living within the city that the rich, they could protect themselves, but they could not seek any kind of justice once the act was done.
As long as no one was caught.
Yeah. And as was expressed about how people looked at the Beggar-Thief Guild War, that the common people and the merchants and such, they weren't too disgruntled by having this warfare going on, because they felt, including the Thieves Guild itself, felt that if somebody was killed during this fighting that was going on, it simply eliminated people who weren't good thieves, you know, for one reason or another.
Seems you cut out.
Hello, I'm going to restart right here. It is page 84, paragraph 2. Outside the guild, however, a thief had no protection. In fact, both victim and guild, with the full cooperation of the city, sought to bring such criminals to justice. Of course, this just made things more exciting for the rebellious thieves, who elected to operate outside all boundaries. Most of the non-guild activity was not robbery or burglary, although there was enough of that. The majority of these operations were of the sort that Gord had just enacted, involving impersonation, cheating, fraud, and the like. Few such swindles were detected, and few of those detected were talked about, but there was still plenty of heat upon the swindlers from both the guild and the law enforcement arm of Greyhawk. The perpetrators were actively sought, their fences hunted, their accessories held as guilty as the actual perpetrators. This made the group a tightly knit fraternity, cautious, clever, and close-mouthed. Some operated only in the upper sector of the new city, some only in the lower, rougher districts, but all were aware of each other by reputation at least. Gord's favorite pseudonym was the Grand Count, a title that played on his size, his impersonation of noblemen, and the size of his gains, although lately he had been partial to his newly developed masquerade as one Sir Margus. In point of fact, the take from gambling was small compared to the profit from many of his other operations, and the proceeds from his recent triumph were enough to support Gord and his two associated thieves for no more than a month, living in the high style they favored. Break. All right. Well, here we've got a good description of what it's like to be an independent thief. That you are, there's not only, you can be pursued not only by the guild who doesn't want independent thieves, but you're also going to be pursued by some core type of law enforcement and justice within the city of Greyhawk. And that would follow you down to not only the thief, the fence. So the institutionalized thievery, you know, also it's part of the makeup of the city. And all, but it is not uncommon, as he's stating, for other non-approved non-guild member thieves to be practicing in the city. We have again that Gord, you know, has become a master of disguise. And that just continues to follow this theme. And also that there is more of that kind of activity with disguise and swindles than is happening in direct robberies. And also that Gord has been so successful that they're bringing in very large amount of coins. If this take of 30 gold coins is not even going to, you know, it's not even going to last Gord and his two companions a month in the high style. Now, here we have enough coins to last, prosper as a academic about 10 years from the one take, and yet the division between the wealthy and, the middle class, if Prosper could be called like a member of the middle class, is vast. I mean, here we have 10 years take isn't going to last the three of them a month, in the high quarter. So we've moved into a much, much different society in a different world here with Gord. Again, we have some idea of structuring the city of Greyhawk the way Gygax envisioned it, with laws and courts, and at the same time with, with having the thieves be part of the respectable part of the city of Greyhawk if they're part of the guild. We have this a picture of a kind of city that is filled, at its basis, it seems like a fairly corrupt city, if the thieves are simply accepted as part of the city structure and social, and recognized as part of the high society. To be the guildmaster of thieves is to be the equivalent of the nobility and the elite.
I mean, depending upon how jaded you are, it may be actually better to have a thieves' guild rather than having people in a society like ours that rob us on a daily basis and don't admit it. At least the thieves' guild pays taxes.
That's right. And, at the same time, it's obviously not stopping, the individuals... individual criminals to stay away from the Thieves Guild. How it seems to be that's mentioned, if not commonplace, I would say it's not unusual for unlicensed thieves to be practicing thievery, even in the High Quarter or the Garden Quarter, and probably throughout the city, everything from, say, smash and grab to muggings to pilfering. I would say that it's probably, it seems to me that must be commonplace in the city of Greyhawk. Mm-hmm. That even that low level of thievery, that must just be the makeup that, especially in a city that has something like the slum quarter, I would assume that, it's real life or death. If you run out of coins, there is nothing in the city that it seems like none of these religious institutions or the culture, that nothing is going to save you from the workhouse or death if you don't have coin to survive one. And so I would expect that to force a much harsher lifestyle of everyone being at least a petty thief, just to make sure that they can survive. So I would say that, the Thieves Guild and the city, they might punish people greatly for being unlicensed thieves, but they're punishing people for being poor, and you're if your choice is then that you're going to starve to death or have to live in those slums, then really your life is, your life is barely worth living at that point. And I'd say that must be a constant threat over the common and, the common laborer population of the city. And, it speaks to me that the city is kind of like gangsterland Chicago, mm-hmm. more where everybody seems to be on the take, are almost like that episode of Star Trek where they were emulating gangsterland Chicago and everybody was a gangster, Everybody was on the take, from the littlest kid to the most common person living there, or the gangsters who are running the society, that the city of Greyhawk kind of seems like gangster land. It might have medieval nobility and such, but it really seems like at the lower levels, the city would be very, would have this mercenary tendency of... And, like a very harsh outlook It's quite a bit different, I think, than what is projected in the later City of Greyhawk. That I think that Gygax has come up with what he felt was much more realistic and much harsher. And I think the City of Greyhawk in this version is a pretty grim place indeed.
Yeah, it's certainly not a fairy tale.
Oh, no, it's certainly closer to Game of Thrones than it is to, like, Tolkien.
For sure.
All right. Well, sorry about that little, problem we had there. And I'm going to finish up for the night. This will probably be a little bit shorter recording than some of the others, but... I try to remind everybody here at the end that they can find the archives of the recordings, on the Canon Fire website. And I believe all 10 of the previous recordings are now up. Well, good night.